Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, and this is our newest episode in our election season series, This American Moment. We're asking scientists and writers, artists and religious leaders and big thinkers to take the long view. Where are we in this moment of American life, and how does it inform the idea of who we are as Americans? Former South Carolina Congressman Bob Inglis has given a lot of thought to that. He was once a climate science denying Republican who believed Al Gore's warnings about the warming climate were nothing more than Gore's imagination. Now, he understands that his refusal to treat climate science was less about science and more about the politics. Bob Inglis is founder of Republican, a nonprofit committed to educating conservatives about climate change. And he joins us today. Bob, where are you? Are you in North or South Carolina, Fairfax, Virginia? Where?
I'm in South Carolina at the moment, which is where I live.
Welcome. So, really good to have you on the show.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
You are, I think, the only person that I'm talking to for this series who has actually served in elective office. So you're a good person for me to ask this question of. I think many Americans believe that people like you, other members of their community, go to Washington with their moral compass firmly intact. They know what they think. They know why they think that. They're good people. And something happens to them in Washington. Does it?
Yeah, I think something does happen. You know, I was in Congress for 6 years, and I was out for 6 years, and I came back for another six. The 6 years in between were really helpful for me to see that and be able to answer your question, which is that, you know, I thought that since I had limited my own term, that I was immune to the cocaine of self-importance. But I found out that I was not immune. I really, in that 6 years, my first 6 years, had developed a view of myself that I needed to be, in the spotlight kind of thing. So it happens to people. I mean, people, and I think you get there and you start thinking, well, this is how I've built my life. This is what I've aimed at. This is what, you know, my family has supported, what people at home are supporting, and I've got to keep it going. It's like keeping the going enterprise going. So there's sort of a self-perpetuating nature to it.
I really like that description, the cocaine of self-importance. I understand why it happens. I mean, you wield a lot of influence as a member of Congress. It's still a fairly small number of people who get to do that. People are asking your opinion. People want to know how you're going to vote. How do you think you exist in that kind of fishbowl with, as I suggested, your moral compass untainted, uncontaminated? Is it possible?
Well, I think the best advice I got was actually in freshman orientation in 1992. A guy told us, all of you think you're really hot stuff right now because you've just been elected and people are putting microphones in their face and they're asking for your opinions on things. He said, change your first name to Former and see how many people care about your opinions. He said, there's one group of people who came here with you, and if you play your cards right, they'll leave here with you. It's called your family. And so he said, that's the main thing to focus on. So thankfully, yeah, I left with my family. So that's a good thing.
When you were first elected, were you the first time around? Were you telling people in your district, I'm going to go to Washington and change Washington? And did you find that Washington changed you in some ways that, you know, were surprising or that you wouldn't want to necessarily admit?
Yeah. Well, of course, it is interesting. I went there as a change agent in the 92 election. It was sort of the precursor to the 94 Republican takeover, as you recall. Class of 47 of us, we called ourselves a class of reform. It's poetic justice in that, the same wave of anti-incumbent sentiment that took me up on the beach in 1992 came and got me off of the beach in 2010. So there's some poetic justice in that, I suppose. But yeah, I think it's, you gotta, I think that the challenge for us at home as we deal with these people in Washington is to let them change, because we...
What do you mean by that? Yeah.
Well, I had an opponent once upon a time who said, I may not change Washington, but Washington will never change me. Mm. And I mentioned that to the guy that used to run Michelin Tire Corporation. Their headquarters are in the district that I represent, Greenville, South Carolina. And Dick Wilkerson, the president of Michelin North America, said to me, I had told me before that when he became CEO of Michelin, even though he'd been with the company for years, when he sat in that CEO chair, everything about the company changed because his perspective changed. And so I'd had conversations about that with him and how we change when we learn things. And so we sort of had a chuckle about that idea that Washington will never change me, because the reality is we do want people to change. We Right. want people to be able to learn and grow. Now, of course, as a conservative, those are scary words for a lot of conservatives. I'm a conservative, but I believe it's okay to change based on data and learning. And it doesn't mean that you've abandoned your principles. It means that you're trying to fit those principles to the realities. And that's what we've got people sort of locked in, where they, are all pledged up to Grover Norquist, for example, at Americans for Tax Reform. He's got a pocket full of proxies in his vest pocket. And so it's all set up, right? And it's set up for gridlock.
All right. Can you imagine any other profession where we would not want the people? I just had an interaction with a physician yesterday. I would find it quite upsetting if my physician was not, the longer she did the job, gaining wisdom and knowledge in the job. I can't think of another profession for which we demand, you know what you know when you said what you know, and that's it. Can you?
Yeah. No, I think it's a good observation, because, It confuses the public sometime about the medical, profession, because, now vitamin D, apparently, according to the American Heart Association, isn't so necessary as maybe some thought. So it gets confusing, because we read these studies and we think, oh, my, why do we have to – they just don't come back when you got it all figured out. But if they don't change – then they're not serving us well, and they really do need to learn and grow. But you can learn and grow and still be consistent with your principles. Just apply those principles in a fresh way.
Yeah, you're a really good person to talk to about this, because you represented a district in South Carolina, and you talked about climate change in that first term, and you were a pretty avowed denier of climate change science. We're going to talk about the science versus the politics here, but why wasn't the science itself persuasive, and how carefully did you study the science?
Oh, I didn't look into the science at all. I mean, I admit it's rather ignorant, but I represented probably one of the reddest districts in the reddest state in the nation, one of the most Republican districts in the nation. And Al Gore was for it, and therefore I was against it.
End of story, huh?
Yeah, I admit that is fairly ignorant, but that's the way it was for my first 6 years in Congress. In fairness, maybe to myself and to those that are entering Congress right now, I had a friend who represented New Haven, Connecticut, in Congress, and he said that being sent to Congress is like being sent to Yale University to take every course they offer in the first year you're there. So some courses you take pass fail. So I took climate change pass fail. Al's for it. I'm against it. Next course.
Okay. And in that time, because you've talked about how you've come to understand that your self-confessed ignorance on this was really motivated by political dogma and not about even trying to understand the science. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I'm like many conservatives at this point. What we heard is basically this: the godless scientist got together with the UN bureaucrats. They looped in the Wall Street traders, and they came up with a monstrosity called cap and trade. Hmm. When that failed, the secret Muslim non-American socialist, he's none of those things, but came up with a regulatory plan to fix climate change, to regulate our very breath. Well, the problem is there's nothing in either of those paragraphs that's attractive to a conservative.
I see.
Right? And so we've got to turn that around, and it takes some turning and some patience to say, okay, it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be a big, complicated UN agreement. And by the way, all the scientists are not godless. And it doesn't have to be a regulatory answer. It can be a smaller government answer, but we can fix this. We got a solution. Yes, we do. We got a solution. How about you? We need to cheer across the middle school gym.
I think you call this populist rejectionism. Is that right?
I don't know anybody else using that terminology, but it's clearly populist, right? The rejection of the science of climate change is clearly populist. It's like we don't need to know, and we want to celebrate people who tell us we don't need to know. And it's rejectionism. It's rejection of the science of climate change. It's rejection of all things Obama, of course. And it's rejection more fundamentally of the idea that we can come together and solve really big challenges in America. And it's in such great contrast to President Kennedy, September of 62 at Rice University, saying we're going to go to the moon. So I think that third thing is the thing mostly to be concerned about is, are we really saying that we don't have it left in us? We don't have any solutions left in us. We just got to go with what we got.
We actually happen to have that segment of that speech that you just mentioned with Kennedy at Rice University, inspiring Americans that this was, we could use our science and our know-how to achieve. So let's listen.
Those who came before us made certain that this country rode the first waves of the Industrial Revolution, the first waves of modern invention, and the first wave of nuclear power. And this generation does not intend to founder in the backwash of the coming age of space. We mean to be a part of it. We mean to lead it.
Bob, what's inspiring about that to you? And how does it speak to today? Yeah.
It's interesting that you play that speech. It's where I go when I get discouraged in this effort at republicen.org, because it's 17 minutes of pure American exceptionalism. Frankly, better than any Republican's ever done it, I got to tell you. President Kennedy admits in that speech that some of the materials needed for the spacecraft hadn't been invented yet. No matter, we're going to the moon before the decade's out. And he admits that some of what he's talking about is faith and vision. And so it's just an amazing belief in America speech. And, you know, I think when leaders are optimistic, they're saying they believe in the people they represent. When they're pessimistic, when they're all down in the mouth, I think they're really saying they don't believe in the people they represent. And so President Kennedy in that speech, the reason it's so inspiring, I think, is incredibly handsome and amazing orator. But it's also that he was expressing great belief in the abilities of the American people. And that, yeah, we don't intend to founder in the backwash. We're going to go ahead. And it goes on in the speech, by the way, to admit that we'd made mistakes, and that we're behind, but we're going to make up and we're going to pull ahead. And so it's just, it's a place I go for inspiration when I get discouraged.
Is it a place you went before you, quote unquote, got religion on climate science? Because you hear him celebrating the imaginations and the capabilities of our scientists. Is this something that spoke to you before that or since?
And not really before. It's just, you know, getting on the science committee for me was really a wonderful opportunity because, you know, there you get to speak with, you know, the scientists that come to the committee, and it really is quite inspiring. I'll tell you, one of those was the flight surgeon for the Apollo mission that we were just talking about, you know, the landing on the moon, and he's a flight surgeon. So I asked him, was it true you didn't know that the Eagle was going to land safely? And he sort of took me aside. He was so excited that somebody was asking. He said, yeah, let me tell you, those were my patients on board, and I was monitoring their heartbeats.
Wow.
And he said, you know what? We had no idea that the Eagle was going to land safely. He said, there was a real chance that it was going to land in moon dust and disappear. We had no idea the depth of the moon dust. He said, so as God would have it, the thrusters came on. Neil Armstrong turned off the rudimentary computer that was supposed to land it, because he said if he was going to land in his grave, he was going to land it himself. So he turned the computer off, and he landed it, and the dust blew away, and it landed safely. But the flight surgeon said we had no idea that was going to happen.
Bob Inglis is our latest guest for our series, our election season series, This American Moment. He's a former South Carolina congressman, a Republican who has now founded Republican, a nonprofit committed to educating conservatives about climate change. He's also one of the guests that we ask among the scientists and writers and artists and religious leaders to consider where we are in this moment in American life and how it informs our perception of our identities. And I will ask him to reflect on that in a bit. Is it true, to come back to the climate science revelations and what you've done with that, is it true that your son opened your mind a bit to, you can't keep holding these views on climate science and, what, win my vote and win my generation's vote? How did it go?
Yeah, so I was in Congress 6 years saying that climate change is nonsense. Then I was out for 6 years after a self-imposed term limit and an unsuccessful race for the U.S. Senate. And so I was practicing commercial real estate law. The seat came available in the House. So I was running again in 2004. My son, who's the eldest of our five children, came to me. He was voting for the first time because he just turned 18. And he said to me, Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment. You know, so his
wow.
four sisters agreed, his mother agreed, new constituency was born. And so, and actually my son was not making a classic interest group threat. He was going to vote for me no matter what, right? I mean, what if we'd lost by one vote? It wasn't his economic interest to vote against me. So,
yeah.
So what he's really saying was, Dad, I love you and you can be better than you were before. So make this Inglis 2.0, the new and improved version. And so it's step one of a three-step metamorphosis for me. Second step, going to Antarctica with the science committee, seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings. Third step, another science committee trip, Great Barrier Reef, Aussie climate scientist named Scott Herron showing me coral bleaching and the glories of the reef. And I could tell that he and I shared a worldview before any words were spoken, because I could see that he was worshiping God and what he was showing me. And so afterwards, we had a chance to talk, and he told me about conservation changes that he's making in his life in order to love God and love people. And so, we talked about that, and I got right inspired. I wanted to be like Scott, loving God and loving people. So I came home and introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009, which is a revenue-neutral, border-adjustable carbon tax.
I want to talk about your faith as a apparently as a barrier to this populist or setting aside this populist rejectionism that you held about climate science. Is barrier the right word? How would you describe the way your faith intersected with a rejection of this science, and then what that means to the, you know, to the way you opened your mind to it?
Yeah, I think it's in my case is a misunderstanding of that faith. Actually, I came to realize that that science really it confirms my faith. Archaeology and evidence of, you know, things that went on in Palestine—that's all confirmatory of my faith. And so it isn't a threat to faith. Science is actually, I believe, part of the search for truth. And so I've come to the place now of realizing that. My view of us and God and science is like my wife and I urging our children to walk. You know, whenever one of them would take a step, you film it, you tell them, you encourage them, come on, Robert, come on, Marison, you can take another step, come on. That's us and God and science. He's saying to us, come on, I'll show you how I did it. Come on, we want to change the DNA of that cancer. Let's wipe it out. Come on, I'll show you how. And so that's what science is that search for truth and the coming of the kingdom, the advancement of that. And so it should not be a threat to faith. And it's really been miscast as that. But I realize that I'm speaking against a whole lot of history there, because there's a whole lot of history about the Scopes monkey trial and all that, and the concern about evolution and all those things that... So there's a lot of history I'm speaking against there.
A couple questions, though, about what you've said. Were you able to, I guess I'm asking whether your faith was the driving reason, along with politics, that you were able to say, I reject this science and I feel firm in my rejection of that? Or... Did the politics take the lead and the faith came in behind that to support that rejectionism?
Oh, yeah, definitely the latter. It was the politics that informed my faith there. And in other words, you represent a very red district in South Carolina, and Al Gore's talking about climate change. It's not hard to figure out which side you're supposed to be on that. And that's where I was for 6 years. It was actually my faith that turned that around.
I see.
It was being inspired by people like that Aussie climate scientist, Scott Herron, to really... figure out, how do you love God and love people in this circumstance with the threat of climate change looming? What do you do? Well, the answer for me was you do like Scott. You take a stand and you risk your seat in Congress. You know, the worst thing you can happen to you is losing your soul, not losing a seat in Congress. I lost an election, but I did not lose my soul, and I'm very grateful for that.
One of the things that Catherine Hayhoe, are you familiar with her?
Yes, great friend.
So you know that when she talks with conservative groups about climate science, one of the things that she encounters is the belief that some Christians have that science, believing this climate science, undermines the teachings about the creation from the Bible, and that the focus for Christians ought to be in the next world. She speaks their language. She knows how to speak about that. But I wonder if you believe that and if you still encounter that.
Yeah, it is a challenge because, and I would say this is where I would turn it to not just folks on the right that have a problem here. It's folks on the left that force the right to have that problem. And I would say this, you know, the joke in Christian circles is that Billy Graham would always say, the buses will wait and we're going to sing all 18 verses of Just As I Am, and you come down front. The buses will wait. The buses will wait. Well, there is an analogous situation on the left where basically the left has some real evangelists for godless evolution, and they insist on it. And so they basically say from the lectern, we're going to sing all 18 verses of I Just Evolved. The buses will wait. You come down up front here and you sign up to Godless Evolution. And it's very off-putting. It doesn't have to be that way. I mean, if we want climate action, we don't have to say that to Christian believers or any believer who believes in a shorter period of creation. We don't have to tell them. We don't have to turn them into Godless Evolution people. We can say to them, okay, listen, it's like my friend Scott Heron in Australia. He speaks at a lot of churches, and the question comes up about the age of the earth. Mm-hmm. And his answer is, I think, the right answer. He says, well, you and I both know that God did it. Now, as to how long he took to do it, does it really matter? We're here. So let's move on to the next question. But many, really, many on the left stop the show at that point and say, oh, no, all 18 verses of I Just Evolved, everybody must come down front and sign up for that. And so it's terribly off-putting to the people that we're trying to reach at republicen.org. Why not leave people with their faith intact and say, you go to church and figure out whether you want to subscribe to that short creation story or whether you want to say that, well, let's see, since the fourth day was when the sun was created, we wouldn't have been able to reckon a 24-hour period before that. So it might have been millions and billions of years. And give a little freedom there. So, but that's something to be resolved in a house of worship, not in the public sphere where we've got to debate science, climate action.
You know, I want to understand, though, what you mean by godless evolution, because setting atheism aside, what I hear when I hear people who are, you know, avowed climate science, climate change committed activists is not, if you're going to believe the science, you simply can't believe in God. I hear we're going to believe the science that the scientists teach or instruct us about the age of the earth. But that doesn't mean you have to set aside your faith as in a higher power that was the catalyst for the beginning. And I mean, I don't hear this as such a binary choice in the way that you're describing it. What am I missing here?
Well, it doesn't have to be, and that's because you talk with wonderful folks, I guess. But there are some people that hear it differently, and what they're hearing is an attack on their faith and a sort of a belittling. They're being told that, oh, you're still holding on to God and guns or something. Well, that really was a bad mistake that President Obama made in mentioning that, right? Yeah, because people are, in fact, let's leave out the guns part, they are holding on to God. And so they, it's better to affirm their faith. This is why people like Catherine Hayhoe are so important to this effort. There's a wonderful scene in Years of Living Dangerously where a guy's getting out of the pickup truck, going into the church, and he says, they catch him saying, I got to go in here and listen to Catherine Hayhoe. She's one of us. And so we don't like to think of ourselves as needing information from the people we know, but that's the reality of us as human beings, is we learn from people who are like us and people who we think, in fact, do like us.
That's true.
You know, I mean, for example, if Scott Heron told me today to swim across this lake, I'd probably do it because I know that he cares for me and he wouldn't put me at risk, right? But compare that with a guy at a conference one time who says to me, did you buy carbon offsets for your travel here? And I said, no, that's a scam, isn't it? Because I just read something in the Wall Street Journal about how the accounting is rather funny. He turns the guy next to him and says, that's what they all say when they don't want to be responsible. If that guy told me the day of the week it was, I'd check my calendar, right? Because he just told me that he's righteous and I'm an unrighteous sinner. Well, that's not a very attractive presentation. And so we in the climate space, people that want climate action, need not to come across as the know-it-alls. I made that mistake in 2010. I think I came across as the smartest guy in the room, or a guy who thought he was the smartest guy in the room. We need to come with real humility to people and say, listen, what would it take to get you in on this? And if I can also say, change the question. Quite often, climate people come at climate skeptics and say, do you believe?
Yeah.
What we should say to those ones on the right is simply, can free enterprise solve climate change? Because that's a very different question.
It's a really good point. Because as I set up this conversation, I said he was a climate science denier. Now he's a believer. But I hear you saying you really want to get to yes, skip over some of that and bring people into. Because you're right. The pounding and the righteousness is not working for the most part, right? We just have to accept that.
Right, because we need to say to people, listen, you can come into this conversation at your point of entry.
Yeah.
And really, if we could, so often the question is asked at debates in front of a Republican audience, do you believe? Well, if the person answers yes, as I did in a very memorable occasion, it didn't go well. Boo hiss came the crowd, right? But if the question had been asked, can free enterprise solve climate change? I could have answered that because there are a lot of people in that audience would say, free enterprise can solve problems you don't even have. And so we may not have a problem, but free enterprise could solve it if you had it. So we got to work with people where they are and figure out, because we'll get to yes. And the reality is that there are many on the left who would agree with that free enterprise solution. The secret that I sometimes tell is that, what we're for at republicen.org, which is a revenue neutral border adjustable carbon tax, is the most efficient way to deal with this, say most economists. It's actually the same thing that Al Gore has been for about 30 years.
Exactly.
So, no, you don't want to go out of your way to begin the conversation that way with some conservatives. But on the other hand, at the end of the conversation, I think it's valuable to tell them that. Because then they can realize, oh, yeah, we really are in this together, aren't we? The idea here is to get to a solution. And so isn't it great that Al Gore has been for this for about 30 years?
You're listening to the newest episode in our This American Moment series. Bob Inglis is with us. A couple reflections here, Bob, from listeners on Twitter. Grant says, thanks for this conversation. It's the most hopeful thing I've heard this week. I'm a Christian, although not a conservative Christian, but today you're modeling a conversation we all need to have if we're going to make progress on climate change. Here's Mike, who says about denial. The denial is multi-pronged, but I feel if the science underlying the conclusions can be understood and agreed upon, we can move the discussion from if it's happening to what. If anything we should do about it. The science denial sucks up all the air. I think, though, before we went to news, you and I were kind of talking about, you know, if you can't force the science on people, move to the place where their minds might open on this. How do you reconcile that with what Mike is saying, like if we could just agree on the science on this?
Yeah, well, I think that what it is it's a solution aversion is what we think it is at republicen.org. That's when we don't think there's a solution that fits with our realities or our paradigm, so therefore we doubt the existence of the problem. That may sound irrational, but here's a plan of surgery for that back problem you're having. First, we're going to take your head off. We got your head off. We can work on your spine. We can put your head back on. Thanks, Doc. I'm feeling a lot better. I don't have a back problem because the solution's nuts. You're not going to take my head off. And so that's what conservatives have heard about climate change, is the solution is just nuts. What? We're going to come up with this monstrosity called cap and trade? Then we're going to do this thing called clean power plant? No, we don't have a problem. Thank you. If that's the solution, I don't have a problem. And so we all are that way. And so what we have to do is overcome solution aversion by sort of starting at the solution. What if we could listen to Milton Friedman on the Phil Donahue show in the 1980s, the father of modern conservatism, saying back to Phil when Phil says, well, you do about pollution then, Dr. Friedman, if you don't want to regulate it. And Friedman says in a very short clip, he says, well, you tax it, of course. You tax pollution. Mm. And so that's what most economists have come to understand and agree with. And so the consensus in the economics profession is even greater than the amazing consensus in the scientific community about the causes of climate change. And so if you start sort of with that solution, then if I've got a solution that fits with my values and with some people that I, you know, respect, like Milton Friedman, then I can begin to entertain, you know, how to work together to get to there. But if you come at it the other way, then if I don't think there's a solution available, denial is a pretty good coping mechanism for a solution that that escapes us.
It's true. I had a conversation last week with Reverend Adam Hamilton. He's the pastor of one, I think, the second largest Methodist church in America. And he used the exact same word that you used a few minutes ago, which is humility. It's an ethic that I think a lot of us in the abstract would revere and appreciate. And yet it seems to be absent from a lot of our political life and our political interactions. Why do we, and you're going to say, well, because practicing it is hard. but tell me why we hold that as an important principle and appreciate it when we see it and find it so difficult to practice it.
Well, I think that's, I think we're in the process, that's going to change because we're taught by experience. And I think we're going to be taught by some real, the lack of humility that's being displayed right now in the highest levels of our government is going to, I think it's going to be a real teachable moment about really the value of humility. You know, I happen to be reading David McCullough's book, The Wright Brothers, at the moment.
Yeah.
And what a description of humility in these hardworking brothers just keeping at it, as opposed to the sort of the gladiator thing. The gladiator thing isn't working out for us. And so we get taught by that, and then so it sort of goes in waves, you know, and we'll come back to realizing we want people of strength and character, and but we don't want people that are braggarts and who don't realize their limits. You know, that's I think we're being taught that, and it's going to be a very effective lesson.
One of my takeaways from David McCullough's book, The Wright Brothers, is how influential their father and their sister was in the development of this new technology. And why I find that remarkable is, you know, these could have been brash young men saying, you're old school. We're firmly in the future here. You have nothing to teach us. But what their family did teach them was what? Determination, resilience, humility, which they embodied, exemplified for the remainder of their lives.
Yeah, it's incredible, really. And of course, going back to that conversation about faith earlier, it is interesting that their father was a bishop. Now, he didn't force his faith on the brothers, but they learned a lot from their dad.
That's right.
And yes, and from their sister. And it's what a great example of how to stay at it, and of course, and not seek the limelight, but to keep going even in the midst of all kinds of adversity. And so, and I think it's also a great place to see the challenge of climate action. You know, is it the Wright brothers are trying to do something that now seems obvious? Well, of course we can fly. It was anything but obvious at the time. In fact, most people, as David McCullough well illustrates, thought it was nuts. People are not going to fly, and you're crazy to try. Well, likewise, the moonshot that we were talking about earlier, you know, there are all kinds of phraseology about over the moon, and you have no more business in that than the man in the moon. all those things were that there's no way to get to the moon. And then President Kennedy comes along and says, we're going before the decade is out. And somehow pulled the nation together, and we did it on slide rules. And, some of your listeners are too young to remember what a slide rule was, but you can go see one in a museum. and it was a way of calculating numbers. And so that's how that spacecraft was designed, on slide rules. And so right now, I think a lot of people feel like it's all the climate challenge is almost as overwhelming as human flight or going to the moon. And so we can't solve it. So what it really takes is seeing it. We're all in the show me state, not just Missouri. And it's why, if I were still in Congress, I'd be advocating in this particular Congress coming an increase in funding for ARPA-E so that we could actually show some of these technologies. And once people can see the solutions and see what future energy would look like, see what better battery storage would look like, then they could say, okay, now that I got a solution within sight, I could get behind this thing.
Carlos called from Minneapolis to ask, I used to be more of a conservative Christian, and I believed the world was coming to an end. I find this is a big impediment to confronting climate change. Has Bob confronted this? What does he think?
Yeah. I once had an Anglican priest diagnose my problem. He talked to me and he said, okay, Bob, you are an optimistic amillennial. You believe that good and evil are going to compete right to the end in sort of a flat line of sin since the fall. Mm-hmm. He said, your problem was you represented a premillennial district, people who believe that evil gets worse and worse and then the end comes. And he says, that was your problem, is that you are an optimistic millennial. You believe that the kingdom comes. And he says, but it does come, you know, it's not going to come completely. That would make me a post-millennial. And so yeah, I once asked a Presbyterian friend of mine, a preacher friend of mine, do I need to change people out of their premillennial views to something else? He said, oh, no, don't attempt that. I mean, that's like me in the evolution thing earlier, right?
Right.
But I think that your caller there is right. There are some people who really do believe, as James Watt famously said, it's all going to burn up anyway, so why worry about it? I think that's a misreading of Scripture. But that's, I guess, a big debate that my Presbyterian pastor friend was telling me I shouldn't try to get into with people.
You've said, I don't believe that history is going to treat the merchants of doubt on climate change any better than we're treating the merchants of doubt on the link between cigarette smoking and cancer. I think about, in the political moment that we're in, that sometimes I think, well, I'll be on the right side of history. And for 1 minute, that feels good. And then we're just then I plunge back into the chaos of what our politics, how mean and negative and malevolent it is. When you think about the arc of history and how we may look back on the quality of political debate today, what do you think? What conclusions do you come to?
Well, I think there's going to be a very harsh judgment for the merchants of doubt, except that it's going to be amazing to find out that so few pulled off something so amazing.
Hmm.
A fabulous film by Robbie Kenner called Merchants of Doubt, based on the great book by Naomi Oreskes called Merchants of Doubt, mm-hmm. details how people, certain scientists and others, PR firms, at the behest of the tobacco companies, blew smoke about the connection between smoking and cancer and were successful for decades in delaying action. The very same people, in some cases, literally the same people, are doing the same thing now on climate change. And the thing that's going to be amazing is when we get through this, when we break through the denial and into the debate about how to solve it, which is where we're going to be celebrating at republicen.org, we're going to find out that it's a very few people. It's going to be, they're going to be countable, Carrie, on your fingers and toes and my fingers and toes. It's an amazing thing they're pulling off.
What, you're saying there's 40 people who are influential and they are bringing along all these other people that don't want to believe the science of climate change, right?
They are creating doubt where really very little doubt exists. And so it's an amazing thing to pull off. Ed Maybach at the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University, which we're part of, has some good data on the fact that it takes opinion leaders to help us to see things, and we respond to opinion leaders. And so these relatively few people, I'm not sure it's 40, maybe 60, it's some relatively small number compared to the 7 billion people on Earth who need an answer to climate change. They are holding us all back because of their, in a way, they're giving us stuff that we want to hear, something that many people want to hear, that we don't have to deal with this, that we can keep doing what we've been doing, and that we don't have any alternative. And so, and then there's some people whose vested interest, financial interest, are such that they want to keep the incumbent fuels in business, and they're afraid of the challenger fuels. So at some point, we're going to break through, and we're going to see just how few it was that were holding us back.
Is your son proud of you today?
I think so. You know, it's like this. A lot of sons are trying to grow up to be like their fathers. I'm trying to grow up to be like my son. He's good looking. He's fun. He's funny. He's smart. He's everything I want to be. So I'm trying to be like my son. So I hope so. I hope I'm getting more like him.
I'm curious about who you read, where you go for, you know, some kind of to push out the noise, to have some kind of clarity in the midst of a very tumultuous kind of political environment that we live in. Who do you look to for words of wisdom?
Well, of course, as I said earlier, you know, when I get down in this effort at republicen.org, I love to go watch the moonshot speech of JFK, 17 minutes, as I said, of pure exceptionalism, and almost never without tears along the way. Just that it's just an incredible speech. And when I'm even maybe more seriously discouraged, I read Psalm 37. It starts with, "Do not fret because of evil men." It just says it over and over that this will pass and that God will break through. And so as I think of the merchants of doubt and what they're doing to hold back 7 billion people and to put at risk this one place where we know we can live. You know, that's one of the things that's so interesting about being on the science committee and seeing all those astronauts who would come by and other scientists associated with the space program is they all had the same experience. When you leave the Earth's orbit and you look around and you look back, there's just one place where we know we can live, this tiny blue dot. And to think that people would put that dot at risk is just anyway. So Psalm 37 is assurance that that we're going to be all right.
Bob, thank you so much for being part of the series, and I wish you much success with Republicen. Thank you.
Great to be with you, Carrie. Thanks.
Bob Inglis, the latest in our series, This American Moment. You can find all of the conversations on my podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.